Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 64, section 6. We're on old single column, page 724. Because we got into this section a little ways. We're in the subsection number 3 on the yellow man. So, as one might remember or suspect, so we did red man and orange man already at the end of the last session. And they're just giving us some basic framework on each of the Sangic races. There's important elements about the different Sangic races spread in various places around the book. But they, in this section, they give you this sort of foundational starting point for each of them, and that's what we were doing is considering some of the basic aspects of where they were immediately subsequent to leaving the homeland there. Remember in section 5 they were getting us going with the Sangic family, and they, we were back with the Badanan tribe, or tribes, there in the northwestern highlands of India. So that's the, in Central Asia, there is their homeland, and as we, if we get far enough tonight, they stayed there in that neck of the woods for quite a while, but eventually they did start moving all over the place, and so each of these, they give you a little bit about where they went and a little bit how they got there, and we when there was something quite obvious, I was pointing out how you could see clear signs of which of the first six adjutants that particular Sangic race favors. It's often very obvious, especially with the primary Sangics. And the revelators will make an obvious indirect reference to that. Often mentioning that famous leader that each of the Sangic races had, and so just to kind of get you to remember what mode we were in. So just jump right in here and take a look at Yellow Man in the same way. It's always interesting to see. For instance, one of the differentials is just at what time, relative to when they started 500,000 years ago, up to the rebellion 200,000 years ago, whether or not there was that famous leader. That race had, when did he come? Before the rebellion, after the rebellion, after they had gotten themselves migrated far away in some location, or what? There's those basic issues of exactly how each of the races got itself founded. Like I said, these are giving you the basic foundational aspects. Of each of the races. So let's see what they say here about Yellow Man.
Number 3, the Yellow Man. The primitive Yellow tribes were the first to abandon the chase, establish settled communities, and develop a home life based on agriculture. Intellectually, they were somewhat inferior to the Red Man, but socially and collectively, they've proved themselves superior to all of the Sangic peoples in the matter of fostering racial civilization. Because they developed a fraternal spirit, the various tribes learning to live together in relative peace, they were able to drive the red race before them as they gradually expanded into Asia.
Okay, so What do they give us there to start out with? So the first to abandon the chase, establish settled communities, you develop a home life, and you're thinking, well, okay, why is that? You continue on. They aren't the spear point race, even amongst the primary Sangiks, like the red man. But, what do they say? But socially and collectively, they prove themselves superior to all of the Sangik peoples. Why? Obviously, right? They're favoring the fifth adjutant. Right? The yellow man favors the fifth adjutant. So it's just natural. They're even giving you that hint by literally using the word socially. Right? I mean, the fifth adjutant is the social urge, or in a more spiritual mode, the social impulse. Right? It's that basic energy of socialization. Right? I mean, if you remember, if you look at the threefold actuality with unity chart, what that additional label is that I have on there for the fifth adjutant. Right? I mean, it's a fundamental energy of socialization. So they can't help themselves. That's just the way their minds work. No choice required. That's just the way they roll. They're naturally that way. And that gives them a significant edge as they continue there. See that they prove themselves superior to all the Sangik peoples in the matter of fostering racial civilization. Okay, it is still racial civilization. Right? I mean, they're not going to have a very natural tendency to be transcending all racial differentials and things like that, and establishing a very high civilization. I mean, if that was the case, you wouldn't need Adamic uplift on the world. But at least within their race, they're, because of that much more solid tendency to establish society upon that foundation, you can get a culture going, you can get a rudimentary civilization going. Okay, so, like I said, with the primary Sangiks, it's just immediately obvious which adjutant they favor, right? And it's so with the primaries, you're looking at four adjutants, 4, 5, and 6, and it's not difficult to link the one to the other. Yep.
Yeah, I mean, there's a tendency for me to think of the yellow race and the social fraternization, natural fraternization, to imply an equality in there, and like everybody's equal. Well, and that's not the whole picture, because they still had social hierarchy that they developed. It wasn't.
But the more. Yeah,
they got along, but they still recognized.
Right, there were still social classes. There was a hierarchy. Yeah, it's only as you take that basic genetic tendency and you amp up spiritual consciousness, like's been happening, ever since Pentecost, and then very much so collectively since the middle of the 20th century. But you started to see enough of that even in the middle of the 19th century, is it surprising that they would be inclined to get into the idea of communism? No, it's very natural for them to think in those terms, right? Because of that bias, and you just amp it up with a little bit more spiritual energy, that basic collective. Consciousness they have, and this is socially and collectively. You notice they even purposely threw in that word. They're going to be ripe for a doctrine of collectivism, right? Because of their genetic, the way mind is attuned to them genetically, naturally. Right. So, everything just becomes very apparent when you recognize that fundamental favoritism for the fifth adjutant. No it's not a stretch at all, right? It's just immediately obvious. Oh, that's why the Chinese are like that, right? It's just, yeah, that's natural. So, you know, and it's an interesting thing that, you know, when you see them pushing themselves to be a little more militaristic, right? You need to ask yourself, okay, so what's going on that they're actually kind of pushing themselves out of kind of their natural state and out of their historical sort of conditioning, right? I mean, it hasn't been all peace, love, and understanding there since the dawn of time there in Asia. There's been a lot, but there were some very aggressive leaders that really inculcated some definitive nurturing towards passivity there, right? And so you know, you've got something very interesting when you see them beginning to depart from that very established mode for them. You know, when they're saying settled communities, you know, you're not talking about, you know, endless raids and barbarism, obviously, if you have relatively settled communities. Home life, things like agriculture, right? So,
answer that question.
Well, just the more you juice up everyone with spiritual energy, right, you know, the more it's going to, yeah, you know, it pushes everyone into that no man's land. You know, that you can think of just simplistically, you know, in animal to human terms, right? There's stable creatures with five adjutants. There's stable creatures with seven. There's no stable creatures with six, right? And the more that you have someone that is really kind of pushing into that space where they haven't gone far enough to really get the objective framework to begin to put a governor on all of that new energy, right? It's a difficult thing, like they say about the Andite. You know, you've got just enough Adamic uplift to kind of get things juiced and going, get it directional, but not enough to get a governor going on it very well.
But it's natural. It's normal.
That's natural.
That,
we have to all go through. We all go through that individually too, right? There's a point in your development where you haven't yet quite gotten the governors established. You know, and we're all dependent upon a culture or parents or something, you know, to try to help us get through that difficult transition time until we can get a governor on ourselves, because we're a bit unregulated, unbridled. You got to put a bridle on that sixth adjutant energy. It you know, it does not regulate itself at all.
It's happening now.
Right, it happens. Yeah, and see, and it happens in individuals, and now we have an emergency situation on the planet where it's happening in the most civilized elements of the world are getting themselves into this no man's land, you know, and we don't want to go back. We need to push through, right? We got to push through to the quest for knowledge and wisdom. Right? See, that's the developmental epic where the governor begins to be put on. I mean, every planet, when it's in the latter part of the material comfort era, goes through this unsettled time, right? Until you can start to really culturize, socialize the functioning of the seventh adjutant as a governor and the objective framework of the encirclement of the Holy Spirit above that. Right, you have to bring that more definitively into as a conscious element of civilization to put a governor on everything running to the rails with that zeal from the sixth adjutant, everything turning into an ism, right? And because it's a material comfort era, it's all material isms. You know, even if they're called spiritual, they're not. They're still material isms. Yeah, and you know, religion is in a fragile state during those times because you begin to lose the genuineness of religion, where it's purely an inner life fact, right? And all of the zeal applied to outer life things begins to ooze in and overtake genuine religion. Religion gets corrupted by this false application of your religious impulse to all the external phenomena, right? Everything that shouldn't be a religion becomes a religion, right? And those religions, quote unquote, become even more material and devoid of, you know, and more secular than they ever were amongst primitive people. See, and that's why it's shades of pre-primitivism. I mean, primitive religion is always quite material, but at least there's, you know, after the very rudimentary stages, there's some crude God notion, right? But in the latter part of the material comfort era, right, it becomes, there's this tendency for it, you become so fixated on yourself and material comfort and all that, that you don't have time to think about a God notion anymore, right? It's just, there's too many interesting things, too many compelling things. That's where we are, you know? And so the revelation is trying to get us to remember, you've got to reconstitute religion. You can't go back to some, you know, I think, because that's material. You need to go forward to something that's genuinely spiritual for the first time. Right? Now more than ever, when you have such a tendency to make everything in the outer life, which is a material outer life, religious, more than ever, you need to consciously say no to that tendency that you're going to do unwittingly, you know, and say, you know, no, religion is purely an individual fact. It is not a group fact. It's just me and God. Right? And it doesn't have anything to do with the lower domain of the hourglass analogy of my mind. It doesn't have anything to do with feelings, because my feelings are tied to the outer life. You got to get above the feelings, because if you don't, you can't get above the outer life, because those feelings are in this, you know, in this life perforce you serve two masters. Right? You can't get those feelings to not be linked to the material outer life. You've got to go above them. Right, to the actual temple within, the upper domain, where genuine religion lies, an unexplored domain of religion, a religion of the spirit.
Right? People haven't even, for the most part, as the book tells us, haven't even had the thought, the beginning, discovery, that God can only be personal experience. No one can experience God for one other person.
Yeah.
And that is just like the only thing that they most, I mean, the whole planet, is that God is, or anything religious, is this social gathering of everything in the external world. Mm. Not one thing. They don't even know. They never even had the thought or had anybody tell them. And
right. So that's why it's, you know, it's such a, like I said, it's such an unexplored domain. And the word just needs to be get out there. There's a lot of people that it just won't mean anything to them. They won't appreciate it. But for those who will hear that and go, oh, you know, and they'll get a reality response to that recognition. And I mean, one of the key things, like I was saying, you got to get above yourself and your feelings, because your feelings, you know, you can't change the fact that they're tied to the outer life. Right? And so how do you do that? Well, there's a thing that you can do that doesn't have anything to do with the outer life and doesn't have anything to do with you. Okay, well, what is that? It's a religious thing. It's like, well, do you mean prayer? No, think about it. No, prayer is about you. Prayer is self-reminding. Worship. There's a word for this higher thing, and it's like, well, you know, worship is about outer life stuff. No, not genuine worship. So-called worship is an outer life thing. You're looking for something that's purely individual, transcendent of prayer, has nothing to do with the outer life, nothing to do with a group phenomenon, nothing to do with ritual. It's an unexplored space, right? You're looking for that new place, right? And even though it sounds like we're getting off to the side, I mean, it's, remember, why we're reading about the yellow races. It's not so that we have the fact about the yellow race 200,000 years ago or something, right? It's to appreciate how each of them, you know, can be recognized, oh, I have a facet of me. Even if I don't have any yellow man in me, you have you have the fifth adjutant, you know? Or even if you don't have any red man in you, you have the sixth adjutant, et cetera. And you study each of them, you know, oh, here's a part, and here's another part. Oh, and I have that part. Oh, and I have that part too. And oh, and I kind of favor that one part over the other parts, right? To get to know thyself, right? It's a starting point of recognizing where you are and what you need to do to get more symmetry, to bring in the seventh adjutant and get some energy of symmetry. And then in that symmetry, you can go up and you can find worship. You can't find worship, this thing we're talking about that people don't really know about, with an asymmetric mind. Right? It's only a symmetric mind that can go up, right, and commune with the cosmos. The cosmos is a universal harmony, a universal symmetry. You can't synchronize with that asymmetrically. If you're not like it, you have no relationship to it. And worship is a synchronization with the cosmos, right? It's synchronizing with what is in common to us all, the cosmos, the common, the commons of the universe of universe, right? The universal harmony. And so it's important to appreciate how we've got, you know, there's nothing the yellow man, like I was saying, I mean, it's just perforce he serves two masters. And by genetic bias, he serves that one master, you know, in a biased way, like all the other Sangiks do. Right? And their challenge is to not exalt that bias to be their god and then sort of existentialize that bias. Right? You know, but each of them did. Each of them gave, you know, named their god relative to their bias. Because that's all they can do. Right? Yeah, and yes, God is that in part, but that's not all of God. Right? And you know, you're looking for a God idea that isn't, it's like, well, my God idea is just like the red man. I agree with him 100%. God is the great spirit. Period, end of story. Well, it's a bias. That's not a symmetric idea of God. You can't get up there with God just like that. Right? Well, we're about to read here with the yellow man. What about the one truth? You know, it's like, no, that's just part. Each is a part. Can you get a God idea that encompasses all those? That's symmetric.
Chris, I have a question that I don't know why I didn't think of this years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So these, what color were the Sangit, the Sangit family before these color children came?
They were just Andonites.
What color was
that? The common pigment that we all have, melanin. You know, everyone has melanin because that's the pigment of the Andonites, right? And so now you've got, with a yellow man, say, you have melanin plus an additional biasing from that center point.
Brown?
Swarthy. Yeah, swarthy, right? Melon, the root word is black, right? When you say swarthy, that's like German Schwarz, you know, the word for black in German, right? I mean, that. You know, so it's you're starting with.
How would you describe it as a color?
I mean, it's swarthy. I mean, you know, it's kind of neutral but dark, right? I mean, maybe you'd say brown black, brownish black or something, right? I mean, just a pure pigment, all of us have very, you know, even the Eskimos have all kinds of other stuff thrown in, blue man and whatnot thrown in, you know.
At least they compare them to animals.
But, you know, just, you know, the swarthy, you know, or just, you know, look up what chemically melanin, you know, what pigment it is, right? I mean, it's sort of a brown black, right? But, because remember, I mean, you know, that basic black hair, black eyes, whatnot, that's, right? I mean, you literally, it's all from melanin. Right. It's all from that black pigment. You've got that starting point, and see just that. I mean, that's the interesting thing about the Andonites, this pre-colored race, this pre-blended race. it just accentuates. You've got this kind of central point. They're low level humans, the Andonites, but it's kind of a central point. They're kind of symmetric by nature. And from that center point, you get six different biased differentials from that, you know, that are set up. You know, they move away from that center point to become a yellow man. They move away from that center point to become an indigo man. And as they move away, the pigment changes and the mind attunement changes. It goes up, yes, but it also goes sideways.
So it couldn't be okay. Too dark, because otherwise indigo would not change from, you know, the melanin.
Right, right.
So it had to be some kind of because then, so let's say that here you are, you're kind of a brown person.
Yeah.
And then you have these kids that come out, and so that has a tendency for red. Well, the red, for instance, it would have to, trying to imagine what it would look like.
Yeah, you know that you got a human that kind of, if they don't have a lot of that pigment bias, you know, they tan brown, right? And so you think of someone that's basically brown out in the sun, they're tanned, okay, they're basically brown, but then they're a red brown or a yellow brown or a blue brown or an indigo brown. I mean, you know, you're just adding that on top of that foundation.
That makes more sense.
Right? Now it becomes a little different if you add in Adamic and you basically wash it white. So it isn't brown, it's super, super, super light brown. It's kind of just white skin. I mean, if you wash it all out, that melanin, then if when you see a differential, it won't look brown red, or red brown, I'm saying that, you know, it won't look red brown. Yeah, it'll just look red. So like I was saying, if I tan, I tan very red, because I don't really have much pigment except a little bit of red man pigment. And if I can keep from burning, right, you see it, you know, and it looks quite red. You know, I don't look like I'm red brown. I look like I'm red.
Yeah, but everybody gets red at first, and then it changes to.
No burning, you know, nothing, just, right, that's my full tanned color, right? So you can see that red man pigment only basically there, because everything else is washed out. You know, by my northern white race paleness, right?
Right. That's why you're stuck in the
six. Okay.
Can't get out of it.
Okay. But anyway, let's not. Yeah, belabor that. Yeah.
You originally started this out, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, which was going into taking where we are. We're in in the end of the. Material comfort age, you know, and that's where we are.
Mm-hmm.
It's not working, nothing we can do about that, so to speak.
Right.
And how we're, you know, how we can see here the different traits that each of the different colored peoples have, etc. And how we, at some point, have to, you know, I don't think it's going to happen without effort to some degree, mm-hmm. or intelligence or whatever, mm-hmm. have to break ourselves up to, you know, a new understanding of what worship is. I mean, for a lot of people, worship is just a glorified prayer.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? They don't.
Yeah. With some ritual thrown in.
Yeah, the ritual gives you a whole lot more understanding of what worship is, and even the socialization of religion you talked about.
Yeah, and if you want to get really technical, it takes you so far, you know, that it tells you that technically what worship is thinking the truth, and that there's a word that you can use. For thinking the truth, it's called philosophizing, mm-hmm. right? And then they tell you that you get to the Isle of Paradise. Guess who teaches you how to worship? Not some priests of paradise. No, the masters of philosophy, right? Teach you how to think the truth in a way that you can synchronize with absolute beings, right? You can worship. You can synchronize, you know, internally on an absolute level with truth, because only in the wholeness of that truth can you synchronize with the wholeness of those three beings, right?
But there's a little hope for us to get some of it here.
Right, and but see that there's more than a little hope. I mean, a fragment of infinity and eternity has been put into your mind to help you catalyze. So even as a seventh circler, right, there's a potential if you supply the favorable conditions. You will be grown up. You can't build your way up to this, but you can be grown up to that. You know, pardon the pun there, right? Going from a child of God to an adult of God, you can be a grown up, right? You can be grown up to that level where you can synchronize a way ahead of your circle development, right? You don't have to be a third circler. But obviously, you're going to have to get yourself out of the way. The more that you have, especially unwittingly, taken a hold of your biases with your white-knuckle will grip and have falsely exalted them as divine, you see, I mean, as long as you're holding yourself off-center, there's no way that you can be grown into a more stable center point and then grown up from that center, right? You got to go up through the neck of the hourglass. That's the beauty of the hourglass analogy. Right? You can't go up on the side anywhere. You hit your head on the ceiling, right, of the lower domain, right? You have to allow yourself to get centered and then grown up through, you know, and be able to synchronize with the wholeness of truth in that upper domain. So it's a great visualization of what you're trying to achieve. See, you don't have to somehow do this symmetrizing thing. There's a literal energy that in your mind that's been given to you by grace. The seventh adjunct is the energy of symmetry. If you just let it function, it will create a symmetric arrangement of your six adjuncts below it. It will do that. It will get you centered, right? You just got to let it do it. Right? And if you've decided there's nothing beyond my religious impulse, that is the ceiling, and I'm just going to make a complete lifestyle solution out of my religious impulse, my sixth adjutant, so you're not allowing the seventh adjutant to function. Right? So that natural tendency to get some symmetry and hence be able to go up through that symmetry, that is being short-circuited. You have to allow your mind to respond to the philosophic impulse. The seventh adjutant.
Right. You don't suppress your religious impulse.
No, you give it space to breathe. You allow it to be eternity influencing you rather than you trying to exalt yourself to eternity. Right? Humble. Right? That's one of those favorable conditions. Right? Loyal, humble, sincere, just, patient. It'll happen naturally if you just dedicate yourself. You know, you have to have some determination to supply those favorable conditions. You have to be determined, right? I mean, I'm determined to be loyal. I'm determined to be humble. And you're doing something, and if you think, well, that's trivial, okay, I mean, you need to reflect on that a little bit more. There's nothing trivial about those five favorable conditions, right? If you can achieve those to any degree, you will be grown up. And you will have the potential to actually get up above yourself, above prayer. You'll climb a ladder of prayer, right? You know, and when you begin to feel yourself going up, you'll transition into thanksgiving, right? Because you begin to look back, I'm growing. You'll recognize you're growing, that you're going up. Right? And there's a natural thanksgiving. And that state of thanksgiving, that recognition, is a natural transition to worship above it. Prayer up into thanksgiving, up into worship. And, we just need to recognize, I'll get back to the Sanghiks here, how each of these are teaching us a little lesson about how we could have a bias. It's not bad, but it's a part. It's not a whole. You know, and to work on getting that part to be part of something bigger than itself, rather than trying to make everything out of that part. The humility to recognize that you're a part to begin with. Yeah. All right. Okay, so back to the yellow. Like I said, this bit about fraternal spirit and the various tribes learning to live together in relative peace learning. You notice it does say learning to live together. Like I said, you know, anyone who knows Asian history or Chinese history, I mean, knows that, you know, this wasn't trivial for them to work through some of those issues. It took some strong leaders to drum it into them. But even way back, that natural collective nature, like they said, they were able to drive red man before them, right? Because the red man is going to have more of a tendency to be individuated, and, you know, they're just like, they're like the glacier to the north, this collective yellow man effective glacier from the south pushing them, right? Because they're just, they function in a collective mode. And so it's just like a snowplow pushing the red man farther and farther north. All right, let's keep going here.
They travel far from the influences of the spiritual headquarters of the world and drifted into great darkness following the Kalagastia apostasy. But there occurred one brilliant age among this people when Sing Langton, about 100,000 years ago, assumed the leadership of these tribes and proclaimed the worship of the one truth.
Okay, so just like we had Anamanalantan with the red man, and, you know, recall, if you can't, you know, you can always flip back. Remember how it said it was 65,000 years ago for them, you know, so they were already, you know, well over here in North America. Again, it's not, relatively not that long ago, 100,000 years ago with Sing Langton.
Well, after the rebellion.
Right, see, so both, you know, well after the rebellion. See, is a thing I was just trying to bring out there, get you recognized, but that wasn't obvious. So, you know, they've suffered all the calamity of the apostasy, like they're saying there, and so that leader is helping them to, you know, get reconstituted after that horrendous disruption. And again, right, I mean, you know, if you look at threefold actuality with unity chart, you have fact, truth, goodness, right, for the individuality, associativity, unity. Right, the associative one, like where the spirit of counsel, the energy of socialization, the fifth adjutant is, it's truth. Right. So, what do they call their god? Ta-da! The only thing that's obvious in their minds. Right? They're going to call him the one truth. Right. They just have a natural instinct to that, and exalt it, to take their highest thought and exalt it. And that's their name for God. You notice that, you know, the, you know, this tendency they keep, you know, pointing out, you've got this very definitive tribal phenomenon that the leader is helping to push to nation, just like Anamanalantan did with the red man. Got these definitive tribes, and they had this strong tendency for all that internecine warfare and killing each other, tribe to tribe, right? To try to, you know, with that individual strong leadership, encouraging them up from tribe to form a nation. But as soon as that leader is gone, there's this, you know, a tendency for material gravity to drag it back down again to tribe. But in the case of Yellow Man, because of this instinct, they, you know, had ongoing lesser leaders that kept, you know, trying to impose this, right? And it was imposable, unlike with red men. All the minor leaders failed in their efforts to try to get them to function at that higher collective level. But Yellow Man could do it because of his favoritism of the fifth adjutant. All right, keep going.
The survival of comparatively large numbers of the yellow race is due to their intertribal peacefulness. From the days of Sing Langton to the times of modern China, the yellow race has been numbered among the more peaceful of the nations of Urantia. This race received a small but potent legacy of the later imported Adamic stock.
All right, you've got the Tarim Basin, right, and you know, in what's currently China, in Western China, in Xinjiang, right? You know, for those of you who remember the Andite papers, you had those Andites, those easternmost Andites, penetrated into northern China there, and that's why you have the civilizational differential between northern China and southern China, because you got that infusion of that greater civilizational instinct with that measure of Adamic uplift from those Andites in the Tarim Basin. That's what they're referring to there. Small but potent. Doesn't take much. I mean, like they pointed out, even as little, you know, of Adamic uplift as we got relative to the number of people on the planet, it's a mustard seed phenomenon, you know, because it allows greater engagement of spirit energy, and that has a geometric quality instead of an arithmetic one. So it doesn't take much to get a significant upset. But even again, see, you throw in a little bit of that andite, and that's going to get a little bit more militarism thrown into them. See, that's going to unsettle it a bit. And so you juice that up a little bit more, and they're going to start thinking more militaristically. So, again, it just that problem with having a little bit of Adamic uplift, that's a positive thing, but if you don't continue up and get a governor on it, it becomes self-destructive. All right, so that's that. They just see, they just give you that little bit about Yellow Man, even though we talked for 45 minutes about it. Okay, so what about the next secondary Sangik? Let's see what happens with the next one here. Oh, you've got a question? Yeah.
Yeah, it's from the previous paragraph.
Mm-hmm.
It's about the etymology of the word Sinlankan.
Oh.
David Jones thinks that's on Asian, so far removed from say. So he wonders what you think about that.
Yeah, I mean, again, see, I mean, we're talking about names of these people. I mean, there's no Indo-European etymology I can dissect here. I mean, this isn't Latin and Greek and Northern European. I mean, you know, this is something in the ancient tongue of the Yellow Man. So
that was his name.
You know, that was his name, right? In Yellow Man tongue, that was his name, right? I mean, that isn't a name they've coined. That was his name. Yep. All right. Oh, you got some too?
Yeah. So it's kind of curious to me that whenever they talk about any of these people assuming leadership of these peoples, I mean, it's a spiritual leadership, but it sounds like it's also political or administrative.
No, it's not. It's not quote unquote spiritual leadership. It's, you know, it's more like Moses, right?
That's what I mean. It's kind of curious that those people, you know, they're always proclaiming the worship of something, you know.
Right. So, yeah, so how does that work? I mean, you have an individual that is naturally above his fellow tribesmen. And what does that mean to be above? It means he has a greater relationship with truth, a greater relationship with the wholeness, and he fundamentally recognizes what the nucleus of that wholeness is. What's the spark at the center of that wholeness? It's a genuine religion. And so they all are going to foster that initiation of the center of this sphere that they're trying to get people to at least, you know, if not recognize, allow themselves to be a part within that wholeness. Right? Allow them to be coordinated into such a wholeness. You can, because of what we are by, you know, our gift from the Father, you can always get people to the spark at the center. They may not have enough high enough quality mind to get them to really encompass the wholeness of truth around that nucleus, but you can at least get them all to the same center starting point, the kindred spirit starting point. You may not be able to get them, right, all to the kindred mind, all with an equal relationship to the wholeness of truth around that nucleus. Yeah, so all these leaders fundamentally recognize that if you're going to have a nation, if you're going to transcend tribes, that's one nation under God. Right? Sing Langton knew it, Anamanalantan knew it. Every genuine knower of truth knows that. Right? What does it tell you about, I mean, the most trivially obvious fact when you get objective consciousness is the existence of the nucleus of objective reality, God. Right? You immediately recognize that everything has to nucleate about that center, or there's nothing. Right? So they all give you that God for everyone to reach up by faith, right, and federate above the tribal level and form a nation under God. But there is no other way. Right? Even amongst all of the same Sangic race, to get above tribes, you fundamentally need one nation under God. And I was saying, last week, definitely when you go beyond trying to make a nation all out of one race, or out of one ethnic group, when it's a polyglot people like us, there absolutely is no other way except under God. Right? And if you go secular, you can kiss civilization goodbye. Right? It's impossible to have civilization except under God. Right? And this can't be some primitive goofball notion that you call God. The higher the civilization you have, the more genuine the idea of God has to be. So what does the fifth epical revelation do? From the first paragraph to the last sentence, it says, you've got, because of the fourth epical revelation uplift, you have a recognition, many of you, of the ideal of God. But your idea of God is pitiful.
Maybe even grotesque.
yes. And literally, we'll just actually say that to remind you of how we see it. Your idea is grotesque, right? It doesn't matter, independent of your ideal, right? Your idea is grotesque. And you cannot have an advancing civilization under such a primitive God notion. No one is going to be one nation under grotesque. That doesn't work. It's got to be something, true, beautiful, and good. Right? In reality, not in your imagination. That's the difficult thing. Many people take their grotesque God idea, in which it's objectively grotesque. They don't see it as grotesque. They see it as true, beautiful, and good. That's why it's sad to record. It's sad to record that when people look at their God idea, they see truth, beauty, and goodness. But objectively, it's horrid. Right? We have to get above that subjective level, right? Where our definition of true, beautiful, and good is if it conforms to our biased mind. Oh, there's nothing more beautiful than when it's biased like me. That's where we are.
Is that where puny God comes in?
Yes, yeah. Having a puny God, yes. Puny like you, right?
Well, they say that's one of the reasons why Christianity caught on in Rome. They didn't have a God that was representative of the culture that they had. So when they got one or started to see one, boom.
Yep.
It jumped right in.
It is very powerful, right? I mean, you bring in a little bit of God. And it's just now, we've got to have something better than the God of the Romans, right? We've moved way past that. The Supreme has been evolving for the last 2,000 years. And we need a better God idea. We got to get rid of notions. We need a genuine, objective idea of God. And it's like, well, that could be a problem because humans have never been able to define the word idea. So, and we've never had a proper definition of God. So an idea of God, well, I think maybe we have of, but we don't have idea or God.
We might not have of.
And like I point out, there's nothing more problematic than the preposition of in the Urantia book, and picking the incorrect sense for it and interpreting your sentence. I see. So even the of is problematic. We have to encompass those three words with an objective philosophic framework.
When you read the Revelation, you get a much better idea of God, I think.
You certainly can, but you have to guard against that tendency. When you're not looking, you drift back to the old ways. You got to kind of keep challenging yourself, and remember that what you're trying to do to be a religionist, what distinguishes a religionist from the run-of-the-mill individual is that religionist is unnatural. run-of-the-mill individual is natural. That's how you go, oh, you're a religionist. What's turning your head? Because that person does something unnatural. Like they have peace that passes all understanding. Right? They have unnatural peace. No one turns their head to natural peace. But if there's unnatural peace, you know that's a religionist. Spiritual is natural. Religious is unnatural. You're trying to be unnatural. So you have to consecrate yourself to that. More and more, every moment of my life, I'm going to do what's unnatural there, not what's natural. Not if it feels good, do it. Right? Not be the poster child for naturalness. I'm going to do what's unnatural. Right?
Not meaning what I also feel is wrong.
Right, of course. Right. I mean, obviously, you know, the challenge is the moment you go unnatural, you've got a whole personal responsibility. You have to somehow objectively recognize what is right and do that unnatural rightness. It takes a lot of responsibility to be unnatural. But that's the whole point, right? You see, and again, you go, well, a child can't really be unnatural. See, there's a limit to how far you can go in being religious as a child of God. All right, children can't be very unnatural. You've got to start moving through that difficult adolescence that you were just referring to. It's like, well, I'm going to be unnatural, but, is this the right thing to do? Oops, no. Right, you've got that difficult adolescent transition stage where you're trying to figure out how to properly be unnatural, but you got to go through that and get to that, you know, you get wisdom through those oops moments. That's how you get wisdom. To get to adulthood, you have to have the courage to go through that difficult adolescent transition phase. But you got to get there because you want to be genuinely religious, unnatural. Right? I mean, Jesus left indelible marks on everyone he spoke to, even in passing, because he was so profoundly unnatural. No one could get it out of their heads. It's like, I met this guy today. He was just the strangest thing. Every way he moved and talked, it was so unnatural. It was so cool. Right?
Come see.
Right? Right. So that's what you're striving for. And it's sad to record that we've started to exalt naturalness, falsely exalt it. It's like, no, you want to be an art form, a true, beautiful, and good art form. Right, of unnaturalness. Right? Then you'll be a religionist. You know, to say, I'm spiritual, not religious. See, I'm natural, not unnatural. I'm fancy animal, not human.
How can you get the masses of this humanity of people that are totally unnatural?
You can't. See? That's
one step at a time.
This is not a dispensational revelation. Yeah.
The odds are better with the guy in the mirror.
Right?
Of getting something to happen.
Start with that person you look at in the mirror, right? If you know that you want to consecrate yourself to this revelation, you know it's a revelation. Notice what it's challenging you. It tells you point blank, you know, the definition of a religionist that humans have never really appreciated. It kind of sort of, but it's never been like right out front. Oh, that's it. It's summed up in that one word. A religionist is unnatural. That's, you know, I couldn't get my finger on it. What is it that's different about? Yeah, I'm going to make sure that I don't slip into that. I'm certainly not going to listen to those false teachings all around me that I should blend in, right, and not be unnatural. Right? I should go with the crowd. I should go along to get along. It takes courage to be a religionist. Cowards can't be religionists. The faint, the timid soul can't be a religionist. Right? Courageous and independent cosmic thinking.
Yeah, Jesus certainly wasn't timid.
No, he was courageous.
And you know, what I find is when you do it, or you try to do it at our level, and you get responses that you never expected.
Yeah.
People actually respond
It's because something happens inside them. I don't know.
We're all encircled in the Holy Spirit. They all have a reality response. See, because that in that unnaturalness, they don't just recognize that it's different. They recognize that it's real. That it's connected to eternity. Hey, it's striking. It's compelling. You don't have to push someone to identify with truth. They can't help themselves. Right? If there's any human quality to their mind, truth is attractive. You're drawn to it. Right? If you embody truth, you won't have to come up with clever arguments, you know, to convince someone. Right? And if you do, you know, and if that's the only way, you're talking to the wrong individuals. You're not looking for fancy animals. You're looking for fellow humans that can follow the truth with you.
It's a good filter.
When Jesus found someone as he was passing by, he just passed by, right? I mean,
ministry is a pass by.
You're looking for someone that when you show them truth, they're drawn to it with spiritual gravity. Right? If you know that's not there, move on.
Yeah.
Keep going. And all the more so, see, when you're trying to actually do the fifth epical revelation, you're not just trying to get them to recognize that they're a person. You're trying to get them to do something with their personhood. You're trying to get them to consecrate their mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. You know, you need someone who can take a hold of their humanity courageously and do something with it. Right?
Just getting them to even open this 2,000 page
book. Right. Warning, not for those timid souls. See, it's just... Yeah, just the size of it, see, scares off most people. That's not the target, you know, audience, right? If they're scared by the size of the book, I mean, it's not for them, right? They need Machaventa. Yeah.
Just give them a website.
Anyway.
So the Green Man.
Let's get the Green Man. We didn't get to it at all yet, right? We're ready to start it. Yeah, okay. Yep.
4. The Green Men. The green race was one of the less able groups of primitive men, and they were greatly weakened by extensive migrations in different directions. Before their dispersion, these tribes experienced a great revival of culture under the leadership of Fontad, some 350,000 years ago.
So that one was well before the rebellion, see? So you notice that. Yeah, you can think about it. I mean, that far before the rebellion, oh my goodness, you know, the rebellion hits, they have no one afterwards to kind of get them re-solidified a bit. You know, it reminds you of just how sort of lastingly catastrophic the rebellion will be if their great leader was before the rebellion. Right? No booster shot, right? Comes along. And just quickly in passing, you know, the Green Man, it's the second adjutant, the energy of rationalization. You can rationalize anything. I rationalize we should go that direction. No, I rationalize we should go that direction. And so they went in every direction. You see it right there. That's the big deal is they're... They're not only favoring one of the first three adjutants, they're a secondary sangic. So it's just an in-the-moment adjutant. It's not a long-term one. You know, it's fundamentally more fleeting, more difficult to have any sort of lasting integrity built around it. And then on top of it, there's a rebellion, and their leader came well before the rebellion. So it's just, you know, everything is stacked against them. Not surprisingly, they're not going to be a very enduring race. Okay, keep going.
The Green Race split into three major divisions. The northern tribes were subdued, enslaved, and absorbed by the yellow and blue races. The eastern group were amalgamated with the Indian peoples of those days, and remnants still persist among them. The southern nation entered Africa, where they destroyed their almost equally inferior orange cousins.
Remember, they already reminded us of that when they were talking about Orange Man, that Orange Man into Africa was followed by Green Man. And the key thing there is, you know, that little passing hint, that one place that you could certainly hope to maybe occasionally find a recessive individual that might be quite green still. And they're going to be dark. They're going to be very dark skinned, but they're going to be definitively green, right, is in India. And sure enough, you know, you can occasionally find someone, you know, especially get good, you know, get good strong sunlight shining on their skin. And you know, yep, sure enough, it's green. But it's also true African. I hadn't seen one, but a couple years ago, I ran into someone just on the street. I was standing on the street corner, and so it was outside, and the sun was shining brightly, and I went, you know, and they were obviously, you know, of African, you know, stock, but my, oh my, was her skin green. It was just beautiful green skin. It was fascinating. You know, and occasionally, you can occasionally see it. You know, there's nothing brown or black or, you know, like I said before. You know, your first non-discerning glance goes, oh, it's a quote-unquote black person. It's like, no. Stop thinking so simplistically. Look, actually observe closely. And there's color there, you know. And sometimes it's quite delightful what you discover.
So if they had a tendency to disperse as a race, do the green individuals tend to be schizophrenic?
Well, it's just, you know, see, there's going to be that natural tendency. They're going to get caught up. It's like, you know, think about them, the problem in battle. Okay, they don't have the definitiveness of the third adjutant to kind of give them kind of a little bit of a spiritual spear point. They don't have the groundedness of Indigo Mammoth, the first adjutant. They're kind of in, you know, Mr. In Between. They're going to be indecisive, you know, and then killed. You know, Indigo Man is just going to take them out as they're, you know, caught, you know, in the decision, trying to, well, should I do this? Or should I... there's so many different rationales that I could, you know. So, they're not going to be great in battle for any long length of time. Yes. And you saw, you know, the naturalness of, you know, the way this often works when you have six Sangic races, the yellow enslaves the green. You know, you see that here. Blue Man got in on it too, but the degree to which they stayed, you know, localized, they would, that those natural tendencies would be there, for the red with the orange, the yellow with the green, and the blue with the indigo. All right, keep going here.
In many ways, both groups were evenly matched in this struggle, since each carried strains of the giant order, many of their leaders being 8 and 9 feet in height. These giant strains of the green men were mostly confined to this southern or Egyptian nation.
Okay, so, that always strikes us like, whoa, 8 and 9 feet in height.
Couldn't even stand it.
Hard for us to even imagine, you know. But sure enough, you know, you think, okay, so if you had those giant strains, both in the orange and the green, there in Africa, and they weren't totally killed. Some of them were blended in. You know, even though indigo is the shortest stock, right, there's going to be some people in Africa with some height because of that. They're probably going to still be kind of tending to be the leaders, even, you know. If you go to a tribe where there's some height, you know, don't be surprised if the leader is the tallest one in the tribe, and it's
playing on the NBA,
and yeah, or playing with the NBA, and going back to this, right, and even when they say, see, they're mostly confined to this southern or Egyptian nation, these tall ones. Well, sure enough, so if other peoples push the orange, green, indigo peoples further south, you know, as other peoples take over northern Africa and drive them south, you know, so you can, well, if they're kind of in the Egypt area, because obviously as they penetrate in, they find the Nile, and, you know, they're going to have a tendency to stay there because of the water. And so, you know, they're probably just going to be pushed straight south. Well, if I go straight south to the higher regions, you know, more higher elevations of the Nile River, I find, like, for instance, the Watutsis, right, who are very tall. Right, see, so, right, it's just exactly what you'd expect. Yeah. So yeah. Again, everything you once they tell you this, you go, oh, that's why. You know, you don't have to rationalize at all. It's just obvious how this matches in with what we know. Yep.
John was wondering if Goliath plays into the giant thing in the David and Goliath.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of giant stuff besides this. Just that, you know, when you bring in Andites with their greater height, you know, that had a tendency, you know, the mighty men of old, you know, so between mythology aggrandizing people and making them taller, and then just the fact of any Adamic uplift brings in greater height than the Sangiks have naturally, you know. It leads to that stuff. But it wouldn't hurt that way in the dim past, there would be stories about, you know, people that are taller than Adam and Eve even.
Yeah.
Right? Right? Really giants, people. You might note that that even plays into Lord of the Rings. You know, and the genuineness of that Tolkien was pulling out of the mythology, you know, and he's got African people joining the big battles. There's these giant, you know, tall people from Africa. See, there is mythology, see, you know, that harkens back to these facts. All right, one little bit here.
The remnants of the victorious green men were subsequently absorbed by the indigo race. The last of the colored peoples to develop and immigrate from the original Sangic center of race dispersion.
And even though we aren't to the indigo yet, let me just say it right there. I kind of mentioned it in passing. Again, the indigo man of the three Sangics is going to have a natural tendency to win out in the end. And so, you know, in terms of the Negroid peoples on the planet, you're going to... It's predominantly going to be indigo in that stock because they have a bias to that most grounded of adjutants, right? The first adjutant, you know, to that basic physicality. It's why, you know, you can have such great athletes. Right? When you have someone who has a bias to their first adjutant, they're just more intimate, naturally, with their body. And so that's... So they end up, you know... winning in the end, just because of that groundedness. All right. So even though they didn't have any giant strains, just because the guy has a very long reach, you can get 50 short guys to come in and take him down, right? it's only a limited advantage. All right, so let's go to Blue Man here.
Five, the Blue Man. The Blue Men were a great people. They early invented the spear and subsequently worked out the rudiments of many of the arts of modern civilization. The Blue Men had the brain power of the Red Man, associated with the soul and sentiment of the Yellow Man. The Adamic descendants preferred them to all of the later persisting colored races.
So, that get that blue-brown and, ooh, sexually exciting. And so, The Adamites favored them.
Is there anything about Krishna being a blue man?
Well, you could, if you start to, you know, you remember about how all the races were in India. And so they have a long history of all these different colors. And, you know, they still have a festival of colors there. And they have these traditions of colors like that. So, yeah, see, it's there in all their mythology, tying back. See, once you recognize, oh, that's not just fancifulness, that's actually hearkening back to the colored races. Yeah. So the thing again in the first paragraph, when they say, and subsequently worked out the rudiments of many of the arts of modern civilization. Why? The arts of modern civilization. You favor the fourth adjutant, spirit of knowledge, right? Like we've been pointing out that, you know, as soon as you got that a little bit more, you got tool makers going, you know, even before you had humans, you know, there's rudimentary tool making, you get that fourth adjutant, right? So you got full-on Blue Man now. When the fourth adjutant dawns in the collective, right, in the middle of the 18th century, if there's greater blue man's stock, is he going to take to that, you know, and kind of be the beginning of the Industrial Revolution? You bet.
Yeah.
Right? See, again, it's because of that favoritism of the fourth adjutant. Yeah, so that's the immediate why of that. But they are, and they're pointing out, they're primary Sangik. So even though as you go from red to yellow to blue, your stature is dropping, your height is dropping, and in some ways you don't have maybe as much of that spear point tendency like the red man. You have a reasonable quality of mind, as they're pointing out there. All right, let's keep going here.
The early blue men were responsive to the persuasions of the teachers of Prince Caligastia's staff and were thrown into great confusion by the subsequent perverted teachings of those traitorous leaders. Like other primitive races, they never fully recovered from the turmoil produced by the Caligastia betrayal, nor did they ever completely overcome their tendency to fight among themselves.
Okay, so they have that too. A bit of internecine issues, like the red man. You don't want to forget that. You don't want to get too fixated on, well, is it just a red man problem or is it just a blue man problem? In general, you've got peoples that have a hard time naturally getting up to nation level. Just, without the prince's staff and having even helping him and all this sort of, influence, external influence. So all of them have a tendency to kind of stall out in various ways at the tribal level. And tribes, in general, just have issues with each other. The only exception is Yellow Man. There's a little bit of tempering. Their tribes have a little bit easier time getting along with one another, especially if they have a strong leader to kind of foster it. But in general, you have a tribal tendency that is, war is natural, right, to the tribal level, right? It's an indispensable to driving tribes towards nation status. So, don't want to overplay this bit about intertribal warfare. In the big picture, they all have issues with it. Not just Red Man, say. Okay, keep going.
About 500 years after Caligastia's downfall, a widespread revival of learning and religion of a primitive sort, but nonetheless real and beneficial, occurred. Orlandoff became a great teacher among the blue race and led many of the tribes back to the worship of the true God under the name of the Supreme Chief. This was the greatest advance of the blue man until those later times when this race was so greatly upstepped by the admixture of the Adamic stock.
Okay. This one's a fascinating one. I mean, just about 500 years after... So it's right in the midst of that. That would have been an interesting dynamic, so near term like that, to have this individual that could kind of get a hold, capture the imagination, and consolidate Blue Man again in such immediate wake of the rebellion. Just 500 years hence, you may have had rebel staff members still alive. That's an interesting, that's a very interesting one to just kind of picture what was going on there and how definitive Orlandoff must have been. Let's see here.
Sounds like Gandalf.
Yeah. Right, so you can't help but notice like, oh, wow, that's starting to sound kind of Northern European, right? And again, these names, that was his actual name in Blue Man tongue, you're going to notice these, the way Indo-European has a little bit different flavors, wherever it, ended up being, because there's a little bit of Blue Man biasing of that Andite tongue, when you're in Europe and those sorts of things. Yep. All right. Anything else that we need to do there? Notice in that parenthetical, but nonetheless real and beneficial. See, again, throwing in the word real to stress that you have this individual that is getting them, you know, moved up again, getting them some more definitive religious nature bound back to eternity, real, right? To be bound to eternity is to be real, bringing that in. Just notice when they throw in that word real or reality, you know, and appreciate its significance. Okay.
Chris?
Yep, the question?
Quick question for mm-hmm. David Jones. Could you remind him what is meant by Caligastia's downfall?
Oh, well, just, yeah, the rebellion. To say it that way, his downfall, he lacked the internal integrity to be sophistry proof. He got sucked in with Lucifer and Satan and went down with them, right? That's why they're using that name, to just remind you of, you know, Caligastia didn't start this, but he fell down with it because he failed to have the ability to stand courageously and independently apart from it. He got sucked into the spiritual candy that Lucifer and Satan were tossing out, you know, and Van had the integrity and others, you know, with him, but not this Lenonidex son, right? So, again, it's all about whether or not, how far you've gone from child to an adult. See, effectively, this Lenonidex son, you know, is still a child. Doesn't have adult integrity of mind, and so he's not sophistry proof. Someone can spin a fancy spiritual, you know, tale to them. And, ooh, that feels so wonderful when you say it like that. When you talk about it like that, yes, yes, you know, you're nodding your head and you're following them without question. Yeah, you've got to not be susceptible to that spiritual nose ring. Right. It's a tricky thing, you know. Spirit is very compelling.
It's still happening.
And it's still happening. Again, that's the emergency, right? I mean, yeah, it's not an emergency if people are plodding along in a very primitive state. That's not an emergency. That's natural. Okay, it's an emergency when they're starting to do very unfortunate, unnatural things. They're starting to use their spiritual potentials in immature ways. That produces an emergency. There's none so blind as those who will not see, right? When you start to unwittingly use your will to wield spirit energy upon your mind and endow that immature mind with this just unstoppable, tangential nature, and you go flying off to the nearest cliff and fall off of it, you know? Yep.
John Stevens has a quick question. Mm-hmm. So when they say the blue men were great people, do they mean great race, or what do you think great means here?
They're kind of hinting at, you know, when they said brain power of the red man, you know, soul and sentiment of the yellow man, that there was... there was a lot of wholeness of nature. They were great in that wholeness of nature. And again, it's because the foundational nature of the fourth adjutant relative to 4, 5, and 6. You know, if you want to have a really proper symmetry with adjutants 4, 5, and 6, you need to ground the 3 in the grounding adjutant of the 4th. I see, so they're naturally grounded. And like they're hinting at there, that means they could work with the 5th and 6th, maybe not as to the high energy degree as the yellow or red man, but it was stable, and that goes a long way, you know, quality over quantity. Right, so they're great because of the quality of the way they were using the adjutants, because they're more grounded then yellow man or red man can be naturally. Right? They're tending to float off, you know, off the ground, especially red man. You know, he gets all floated off the ground with the sixth adjutant bias. And he's so heavenly minded, he's no earthly good. So that's the, see, again, once you appreciate the adjutant favoritism, you can, that's your main way of immediately recognizing, properly interpreting why they are the way they are, answering that why question. You know, they say something and you say why. Think about the adjutants. And the more you understand about the adjutants, the more you can interpret them properly. All right. Okay, so I think we're ready to go here.
The European researches and explorations of the Old Stone Age have largely to do with unearthing the tools, bones, and art craft of these ancient blue men, for they persisted in Europe until recent times. The so-called white races of Urantia are the descendants of these blue men, as they were first modified by slight mixture with yellow and red, and as they were later greatly upstepped by assimilating the greater portion of the violet race.
Okay, you know, we've already talked about the fourth adjutant quite a bit there, the art craft and everything. But notice the one, the key thing, to really appreciate how the northern white race, especially, ended up being the way it is. It isn't just blue man with Adamic uplift. It starts out by neutralizing the color a bit. Like they, see, they throw you throw in a little yellow and a little red. You know, see, so that tends to get it to more of a neutral brown, right? And then you bring in the whitewash of the Adamic stock, you know, and just basically wash all the color away. You know, but it's washing away in a very centrally located in the color scheme right way. And so you have this basic white race, see, then. You know, rather than just having it be a diluted color, you have it being a diluted brown because of that. And fundamentally because of that, there's a recessive yellow or red. You know, so occasionally, if you look at a very northern white race person that's quite white skin. But you'll know, well, actually, if you look at their skin closely, especially if you put them side by side, it's like, oh, actually, when I see it like this, you have a bit of yellow to your skin, don't you? Or you have a bit of red to your skin, and you can see that. And it goes all the way back to the founding of those Sangiks that moved into Europe. All right. Let's see, I guess we got everything there. Remember with the Old Stone Age, so that finding all kinds of delightful archaeological discoveries, post 500,000 years ago, the Paleolithic. Remember how they reminded us that we ought to use the Eolithic for before 500,000 years ago. And so I'm just bringing that in again. So the Old Stone Age, the Paleolithic, and going up to modern times. The Paleolithic goes all the way through Adam and Eve arriving and everything. Okay, so they're just reminding you of that, and you're going to have a very definitive thing with the blue man stock there in the fourth adjutant. All right, so let's get the last one here.
6, the indigo race. As the red men were the most advanced of all the Sangic peoples, so the black men were the least progressive. They were the last to migrate from their highland homes. They journeyed to Africa, taking possession of the continent, and have ever since remained there, except when they have been forcibly taken away from age to age as slaves.
The last little bit, little history lesson, is if you hadn't figured it out, it's not just a colonial phenomenon or something. It goes back as far back as people go back. But now, here's a great example. You know, they often speak to us in just our parlance, right? We tend to call all of that secondary Sangic stock, all of that Negroid stock on the planet, black men. Right? So don't get confused by that. That's, you know, they're not speaking in precise color terms there when they say black men there. They're just speaking in our colloquial terms there. But look out for occasionally them referring to black and noticing, oh, here they aren't just saying that because that's the way we imprecisely talk about it. They literally mean you have some peoples where they have a quite equal blending of orange, green, and indigo, and these are genuinely black men, very, very dark brown black men. But you can tell here, all right, we're talking about literal indigo, right? They haven't blended it yet. They haven't gotten to Africa. So just, you know, don't get confused by that. You know, just kind of stay on your toes and notice when they're using it imprecisely and when they're using it precisely.
Remember when you brought that National Geographic magazine that mm-hmm. time?
Yeah. Yeah, and you and again, like I said, you know, just it's easy to do. Just, you know, almost every picture that you see of people in Africa, just take a close look. It's very easy to see one if you actually look. It's like, oh, actually, their skin is kind of indigo, isn't it? I mean, lots and lots of those people are not brown or black or chocolate or whatever. I mean, they're quite indigo in their skin color, and it's also quite easy to see someone that's orange. You know, much more orange. Green, see, that's pretty rare. It's just difficult to see a green. But, and then, like I said, you know, you'll find someone who is just ebony skin, right? And you know that they're a blend. And you shouldn't be surprised if amongst them, those really genuinely black men, you might have someone who, or a tribe that has a little more tendency to be a little bit more progressive, a little more balanced, a little bit more leadership kind of, you know, like in a country, that tribe might, you know, tend to produce the leaders of the country a little bit more, because that's going to give them some symmetry to have that more, the blend of the three Sangiks. Yeah. So, yep.
In Ghana, which is in West Africa, there was quite a bit of variation in color,
mm-hmm.
but in general, they were much darker than people we consider black yeah. in this country.
Yeah.
And there was a far greater number of people that you can recognize as indigo. Mm. I mean, just to the point where you even would say, is he really black? It's uh-huh. it's not really a definitive black color. It's it's kind of a purplish hue to it.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's a really pretty color when you see one of them that has. They're quite definitively into it. I think it's a really cool color. It's a very appealing color.
Have you noticed that the Maasai over there in Africa? They're kind of orange.
Yeah, you can definitely see some of them. Yeah, they'll have a much more orange, you know, tone to their skin, and you can literally, you know, have you're reading a magazine article, you know, and they show this picture of this little group, and you know, several people in that group are pretty orange, and then the picture, you know, in the same basic area, this group is like, oh, but they're more indigo. I mean, you know, it's because you just, yeah, it's going to be mostly indigo or, you know, a brownish, you know, if they're blended. But every once in a while, you got recessive individuals, you know. Okay, let's see. Anything else that we need to do there? Oh, just, you know, when they said the least progressive, again, that's just that spear point thing. You know, the more you back off of having a relationship to, you know, more spiritual quality of mind, like the sixth adjutant, the less you're going to kind of lean into your life, right? The more laid back you're going to get, you know, and so, you know, the less that you just end up being progressive, quote unquote, as they're saying there. And everyone who knows, you know, African culture, In general, they're very laid back about things. You know, you can set the church service for 10 o'clock, and, you know, that's just, you know, that's just a suggestion. They're very laid back about it, you know. They sort of just come in when, you know. It's all very, you know, they're not leading into this whole, you know, their life like Andites tend to do, right? Yeah.
Here, we tend to go to church from, you know,
10
to
11. They go from 10 till forever.
The church services were very, very, very long.
Yeah.
And they met oftentimes three and four and five times a week. Yeah. They made up for, I mean, it's like they went to the other extreme in this definitive push.
Yeah.
For a religious consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, so it's fun to just think about, you know, what things they do that is really predicated on their nature, and then what things are, you know, our nurture, you know, the various cultural influences that are imposed upon them, and they delight in. It's like, oh, that's cool. Let's do that. You know, and they'll take off with it. So we're all this, you know, we're all a blend of nature and nurture like that. You know. Yeah. Okay, let's keep going here.
Isolated in Africa, the Indigo peoples, like the red man, received little or none of the race elevation which would have been derived from the infusion of the Adamic stock. Alone in Africa, the Indigo race made little advancement until the days of Orvanan, when they experienced a great spiritual awakening. While they later almost entirely forgot the God of Gods proclaimed by Orvanan, they did not entirely lose the desire to worship the unknown. At least they maintained a form of worship up to a few thousand years ago.
Yeah, you know, and that's the thing that is, you know, kind of fascinating about the peoples in Africa that were very isolated. Parts of Africa, you know, that weren't on any of the trade routes and stuff. You know, just how recently it is that they adopted sort of any sort of a, what you would call a religious sort of culture, as they're hinting at there. They lost sight of a lot of that, and you have these pockets where when you think about kind of where they're coming from in their religious ideas. They're basically sort of the shadows of Melchizedek missionaries is kind of what they have for a religious consciousness. You know, because they were untouched by the Muslims or the Christians or whatnot, you know, until very recent times. And some current missionary will go there and they find someone that's just kind of, you know, they've got these shades of what was coming from the God of Gods and little hints of kind of what the Melchizedek missionaries, you know, might have given them, and that's about it. So they're kind of fascinating anthropologically like that in terms of their religious culture.
Didn't Simon Zelotes end up down there?
Yeah, I mean, you had some people that went in there, but of course there's always that tendency for the, you know, to only go in the more northern parts of Africa when you're penetrating like that. And if they do penetrate deeper to go the trade routes, you know, but the real out of the way places, you know, just no missionaries, you know, penetrated until very recent times. All right, let's see. And it's kind of the one little side thing there is pretty funny because they did not entirely lose the desire to worship the unknown. A lot of 19th and 20th century sophisticated thinkers sort of rediscovered the unknown, and have delighted in kind of having that notion of God as the unknowable. Okay, and then they throw in one other little tidbit here.
Notwithstanding their backwardness, these Indigo peoples have exactly the same standing before the celestial powers as any other earthly race.
See, it should be obvious why they devoted a whole paragraph to just that one little statement, and it's a bottom line statement. Because as we talk about all these material and mindal issues, you don't want to lose sight of the fact that every one of us has an encirclement in the Holy Spirit and a personality from the Universal Father by grace, regardless of our foundations, our foundational genetic issues. And we're, you know, the Universal Father, especially along these lines, can't love anyone relatively. Right? He loves all of us absolutely. Doesn't matter if you're the most limited pure indigo, you know, or the most glorified material son or daughter on Gerasim or whatever. I mean, you know, there's absolutely no difference to the spiritual father. Right? He's not a material father. He's not a mindal father. He's a spiritual father. Right? Spiritually, they're all the same. Right? Right? So that personality from him is identifying with that common encirclement in the Holy Spirit that's exactly the same for every being. Right? The foundation is the same. Even a material son or daughter, right? When they get encircled in the Holy Spirit, right? I mean, that initial encirclement is exactly the same as yours. Now, their personality identifies with the exact same spiritual fact. Right? We're kindred spirits. And that's just a shadow of the fact of who's behind that, a being that can't love you differentially, can't love anyone relatively, right? Can't even love you temporally, right? He loves you as an eternal fact and equal, fundamentally equally. All right, so, you know, can we, with all of our juicing up of our spiritual consciousness, can we hold on to that with pure clarity and yet consider these factual, material, and mindal issues objectively? Instead of having that diffuse over and confuse us, where we start to ignore our factual differences. All right. So there's the little thumbnail sketches of all six of them. Now, what else are they going to tell us here?
These were ages of intense struggles between the various races. But near the headquarters of the Planetary Prince, the more enlightened and more recently taught groups lived together in comparative harmony. Though no great cultural conquest of the world races had been achieved up to the time of the serious disruption of this regime by the outbreak of the Lucifer Rebellion.
We'll get to that, this story of the prince and his staff here before too long. But you may recall, for those of you who are familiar with the book, that it was very slow going with the prince's staff trying to get civilization, you know, kind of in the same way the adjutants, it took them a long time to finally find the proper synchronization. The prince and his staff are having a similar time with it. But nonetheless, you see they're mentioning comparative harmony. Before the rebellion, they were definitely providing an influence as unnaturally symmetric as these peoples were, right? The humans have a very strong instinct to imitate, especially when it strikes them as fancy, right? Yeah. And you can imagine how fancy the doings of the prince's staff were to all these primitive peoples, right? And so, right, they were getting into it, and they were following it, they were parroting it, but it's just, you know, they couldn't hold that themselves, right? They could imitate, and sometimes imitate well, relatively well, but you take away that proper influence, or even worse, you actually give them a counter-influence like the rebel staff did, you know, and they're going to imitate that just as religiously, quote-unquote, and yeah, very, very problematic. you can imagine how attentive these students were. And so, you know, they just were hanging on every word. And when those words started to go astray, you know, they just followed it religiously off the cliff. It's, you know, it's like going to the probationary nursery. Yeah, that's a Lucifer rebellion. It's very unfortunate. Okay. And you notice how they, though no great cultural conquest. Again, think about that society, culture, civilization. They were having a hard time getting it sparked in a better way beyond that basic rudimentary society, social level. But you had, you know, you remember there were definitely part of the staff was devoted to trying to work on that sparking, you know, getting it from society to culture, getting that religious element more definitively in play. I'm belaboring this. I'm trying to get you to, yeah, obviously, to not just blow through these words. Kind of notice, you know, the subtleties that, you know, of their selection of words. All right, let's keep going here.
From time to time, all of these different peoples experience cultural and spiritual revivals. Monsant was a great teacher of the post-planetary prince days, but mention is made only of those outstanding leaders and teachers who markedly influenced and inspired a whole race. With the passing of time, many lesser teachers arose in different regions, and in the aggregate, they contributed much to the sum total of those saving influences which prevented the total collapse of cultural civilization, especially during the long and dark ages between the Caligastia Rebellion and the arrival of Adam.
Yeah, you think the 9 centuries of the, you know, so-called Dark Ages or Middle Ages, you know, from the 5th through the 13th century was long. How about 150,000 years? Now there is a long Dark Ages. no, and just, you know, since I mentioned it, see, notice them saying the collapse of cultural civilization. Just, you know, emphasizing that the cultural, you know, so it's a rudimentary civilization.
Well, 200,000 years
old. Yeah. now the interesting little thing that they throw in there is about Monsant. Okay, I mean, you may recall, because we talked about this before, you know, when you flip back and let's see what paper is that again. That's paper 45, when they give the 420 counselors in section 4. You know, there's a curious one when you're reading there. You have, it starts with Onagar, and then they say there's this Monsant person. You know, they say the great teacher of the post-planetary prince age on Urantia, who pointed his fellows to the veneration of the great light. And then they go on to Anamanalantan and Orlandoff, et cetera. You know, they go through the 6 Sangic leaders. And you're going, well, who is this Monsant person? And if you, you know, notice carefully what they say here. But mention is made only of those outstanding leaders and teachers who markedly influenced and inspired a whole race. Put 2 and 2 together. Oh, so they've already mentioned the singular individual that inspired the red, the orange, the green, the blue, the indigo. There's only one race left, the Andonites. Oh, there was an Andonite leader, Onagar, pre-planetary prince, and one post-planetary prince. See, Monsant is an Andonite. Because remember, there's lots of Andonites on the planet. As the Sangics start to migrate, they get shoved up to the northern regions. But see, put 2 and 2 together, right? And they're mentioning him, and they're only mentioning him when they're impacting a race, and they've already mentioned all the Sangic races. Right? So you know he's an Andonite, like Onagar.
And the Nodites really didn't count.
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, that's a separate issue, right, the Nodites.
Well, I have the same question. How do you know it's not a Nodite?
Well, I mean, if you want to think about that, remember, technically, the Nodites are fancy Andonites, you know. But But I mean, the whole point is, you know, is there, you know, the non, he's a non-Sangic, right? I mean, exactly what the, you know, the blend is here. I mean, again, you can't guess. But you know that fundamentally he is, he's someone that's impacting those Andonite peoples,
right? The whole race.
Right, the whole race. See, yeah. All right. Let's see, anything else there? Let's see. Just that, you know, maybe the mentioning about how they contributed much to the sum total, those saving influences which prevented. Notice that they're pointing out that there were a lot of times when those who were watching going, I don't know, this is looking tenuous. And then coincidentally, right, a minor teacher rose up and, you know, gave a little bit of integrity back to it. The evolutionary process produces these minor influences that kept things going, you know, in this case, until Adam and Eve.
You know, so they let the world go for like 100,000, 200,000 years. It's only been 2,000 years since Jesus was here. Maybe they'll let us suffer a long, long time before, you know, something happens.
Yeah, like I said, you can, you know, this points, that's why I threw that out there. You know, I mean, your first thought about, well, if we do end up going into an interregnum again, you know, I don't think it's going to be very long. It's like, well, but you can't say that for sure. Hmm. Yeah, it could be a very long time. I don't know. It all depends. Yeah. You, case in point, sometimes it is long. But it's, you know, the counter argument is, yes, but it's naturally a long time from the planetary prince until the Adam and Eve. You know, on every world, and the counter to that is, well, yeah, but, you know, read about the planetary mortal epics, you know, all of them are very long, you know, normally. Yes, the counter to that is, yes, but Michael, you know, changed that by jumping over the magisterial sun and kind of short-circuiting in it and bringing in the accelerator, the spirit of truth, and so wouldn't that mean that in much shorter time we're going to get a magisterial sun? And after all, they wouldn't give us the precursor to the magisterial sun, the fifth epical revelation, way in advance. So you can argue it back and forth. Yeah, there's sort of a counter argument back and forth and back and forth.
And the revelators argue it back and forth.
Yeah, and the revelators argue it back and forth too. But it is important to just bring in that humility. It's like, well, they would, you know, God would never, you know, let us languish in darkness for a long time. Are you sure? 150,000 years is a long time.
The argument is you're
going to
die around 80
or 85. Yeah, right. You can
see what you want.
All right. Okay, so now you notice there's a large paragraph break. They give us a little side about Sangic races in general here.
There are many good and sufficient reasons for the plan of evolving either 3 or 6 colored races on the worlds of space. Though Urantia mortals may not be in a position fully to appreciate all of these reasons, we will call attention to the following.
Okay, before you go in, wait a minute, we talked about this before. Remember not too far back here, you know, there in paper 63, at the end of section 4, let me just reread that little paragraph where they brought up this issue, where they said, it is impossible to induce such primitive beings long to live together in peace. Man is the descendant of fighting animals, and when closely associated, uncultured people irritate and offend each other. The life carriers know this tendency among evolutionary creatures, and accordingly make provision for the eventual separation of developing human beings into at least 3, and more often 6, distinct and separate races. So they already gave us one little bit about this issue, about why there are the races, just for the simple thing, so that you don't end up with a bigger and bigger pool, so that more and more people don't have elbow room. They're naturally going to split into three or six, pools of people because of their tendency to like their own kind and want to move away from those that aren't like them. So that's one reason right there that they already gave us. Every world has this issue, and that's one of the reasons why you have the races, just so they go, I don't like the way you think. I'm going to go move over here. And the lifeguards are going, all right, cool. So they're going to kill themselves less now. it's helpful to get them separated. And you'll see as we go through this list here, between the lines on one of them, is what that example they just gave there is under the general umbrella of one of these bullet points here. Okay.
One. Variety is indispensable to opportunity for the wide functioning of natural selection, differential survival of superior strains.
Okay, so number one is that very basic biologic Darwinian fact, right? Survival of the fittest, natural selection. It's interesting to note that the first in the list is, the most definitive challenge to many spiritually conscious people and, religionists, so-called religionists anyway, to want to reject such cruel Darwinian thought. God would never think like that. He would never set up a system that was like that. Yes, he would.
God thinks, just ask me.
Yeah. So this gets back to when we were talking earlier about getting a better idea of God. Remember, a better idea of a God is a more challenging idea of God. Not for those timid souls. Right? Evolutionary facts are harsh. Right? And evolution is God's creativity in time. Right? You've got to somehow not lose sight of the God who is love at the same time you face facts. Right? You need to take this up. Your higher idea of God requires a better idea of the word love. See, to go with it. Because the facts are more prickly. Okay, a trivial so-called love can handle fuzzy facts, but solid, rigid facts are prickly, and you're going to need to take your idea of love up from just some feeling. Right? How can the God of love, right, give you bullet point number one, survival of the fittest? And war is an indispensable. Slavery, war, social classes, profit motive are indispensables. Right? So you need to get, again, they're trying to ground you, get you grounded in the facts. Face facts and adjust them to ideals in order to achieve wisdom. Right? They know you got the ideal of God. Now they're trying to get you to face facts. And out of the other end, super additively, will come a better idea of God. The definition of the word love will have to improve.
Two, stronger and better races are to be had from the interbreeding of diverse peoples when these different races are carriers of superior inheritance factors. And the Urantia races would have benefited by such an early amalgamation, provided such a conjoint people could have been subsequently effectively upstepped by a thoroughgoing admixture with the superior Adamic stock. The attempt to execute such an experiment on Urantia under present racial conditions would be highly disastrous.
Okay, before we deal with the last sentence, just the more contextual facts here. So again, it's interbreeding, it's genetics. We're still in the foundational questions here. And now they see they're getting into more of the subtle details of dominant recessive genetics, right, and how problematic it is when you have negative recessive genetics, so that you occasionally get those very unfortunate recessive combinations. Stronger and better races are to be had, right? You know, so when you have superior inheritance factors. So, you know, the Brinson and his staff, and especially Adam and Eve, you know, they're working on trying to limit how much you get unfortunate tails to the genetics in the races. Trying to keep them, well-founded, so that when you blend them together, you don't have a lot of negative recessive combinations. But when you blend them all together, it is going to, it's going to be symmetric, but it's going to be at a relatively low level, especially on a world with all six races. You blend them all together, and it's going to bring, the final result down from the spear point of the red man, say, for instance, right? And that's why you need a thoroughgoing admixture. You're going to need a full-on, very definitive uplifting, because as you blend them, it brings it down. So you're very much going to have to uplift it. So they're just giving you that basic physics of it, and then they throw in, this challenge to our spiritual consciousness, right? Our unity consciousness. We got to face the facts. We have very little Adamic blood. If there's any definitive attempt to diffuse that throughout the whole billions of people on the planet, you can forget it. You'll have a completely uncivilizable people. It just won't be all the king's horses and all the king's men won't be able to put it back together again. And that's why you know that there was permission to conserve the better strains. It was asked for anyway. We don't know if it was given, but they were definitely asking for that because they knew we were going to have this growing overplay of our unity consciousness. We should equalize ourselves. We should just blend it all equally. It's like, no, you need to think a little bit more realistically than that, because it's not magic that there's civilization. It's fundamentally dependent upon that Adamic blood. Now, on the flip side, they'll do whatever it takes to make sure that we don't drop below that line. We don't have to be hyper fearful about this. But what they're trying to do is just get us to temper our tendencies. It's like, let's help them out a little bit here, right? And not try to turn the planet into drops of water that blend into an ocean. Don't overplay your unity consciousness like this. Keep the spiritual separated from the material. This is a material issue, not a spiritual issue. Don't apply your spiritual understanding to it, your unity understanding. Yeah. So, again, we're hopeless at that. Right? We're constantly not keeping it separate. Jesus couldn't get the apostles to keep it separate. None of us are keeping it separate. It's a big problem in so many ways. All right. What else is there? Is it all just biology? Let's see here.
3, competition is healthfully stimulated by diversification of the races.
Getting a little bit. So having that differential. Remember how they tell you that, your unity consciousness thinks that competition is bad, but even the angels on high are put in intense competition. Like one local universe to the other. It's like, we're gonna outdo Avalon, boy. There's competition. You need that, those energies in play. So that's a reason to have the differential for competition to be natural, right?
4, differences in status of the races and of groups within each race are essential to the development of human tolerance and altruism.
Ah, the indispensables. I mean, not the indispensables, the inevitabilities. Wrong I word, because I said indispensable not too long ago. Yeah, the inevitabilities. Right? You know, is altruism desirable? Then must. And of course, the basic way you sum that up is with the indispensables, the social classes. Right? See, as they're pointing out, you know, or groups within each race. Right, social classes are indispensable to the inevitabilities. Right, so that's going, you know, beyond just the material or the mental, intellectual, to pushing towards the more full-on spiritual altruism. Yeah, the genuine altruism.
Not blind altruism.
Yeah, not. You know, not things that masquerade as altruism, right?
His key is how that sentence begins. Differences in status of the races.
Yeah.
I mean, you have to face that fact.
Yeah.
That the races have a differential in status.
Yep.
Spiritually, no.
No.
Materially.
And intellectually, yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So you can see, I was just trying to point out, see, it's a matter, mind, and spirit issue, why there are Sangic races, you know, different Sangic races. Okay, what about number five here?
Five, homogeneity of the human race is not desirable until the peoples of an evolving world attain comparatively high levels of spiritual development.
See, if you think about it, between the lines of that one is, you know, what I flipped back to there. About them, you know, about, you know, how you're naturally irritating if you're, you know, if there isn't enough elbow room. I mean, you can be grouped pretty tightly together if there's a lot of internal integrity, comparatively high levels of spiritual development. But when there's not, in the early stages, the life carriers have to do something to naturally drive them apart so they don't just stay in one pool and kill them all, you know, everyone kills themselves off. So that, and again, the word homogeneity, oh, something that would very much please my unity consciousness, right? Sameness. So until you have a more sophisticated, holistic mind, you have to be careful about that spiritual part of that whole mind being given too much play. That's what they're saying there.
Which is going on so much now.
About, using the United States as an example of all the religions and all the races covered by law,
yeah.
You know, how they can exist together.
Yeah. Yeah, and having a subset of people like that, you know, start to intermarry and blend together in a very complete way, that's okay. Yeah, you know, remember what they said up there. The attempt to execute such an experiment on Urantia, right, you know, would be highly disastrous. You don't want to go global with that thought, but, you know, especially, you know, with the superior inheritance factors. You know, if you've got people coming from all the various places in the world who are the individuals that have more of a directional future orientation consciousness, if they say, you know, I need to go out of here and go to that United States place. I hear there's a group of people there that are really oriented towards the future, and my people are just like stuck in the past. I'd like to join a people that are really oriented towards the future. You know, more and more so, those people, it should be okay for them to blend together quite a bit biologically. Right, there's going to be less and less of the problematic recessive negative genetic issue. But again, see, that brings in, oh, well, what if we just make the people of this country like everywhere else genetically?
That's what they want.
All right, that's a problem, see. That would, again, would bring in the highly disastrous. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, there's no way to... You need to face the fact there's lots of examples all over the planet of people who aren't naturally oriented to be highly civilized. They're completely content being in a relatively primitive state. That's their natural state, and they don't have a tendency to be very unnatural.
Leave them there.
You know, and you just, they're children of God. They're fine, right, in that sense. But you got to face the genetic facts. You can't blend it all together.
Put up a wall.
There's no way of having a thoroughgoing admixture right now. We don't have millions and millions of Adamic people, right? So, we have to think in loving but practical terms, right? You know, you're joking about walls, but again, right? I mean, the very first thing that Prince and his staff did is build a wall. Oh. Very first thing that Adam and Eve did is build a wall, right? For these reasons. Right, it's just, if you want to just go with the Bible, I mean, God is constantly telling him in the Old Testament, you need to build a wall, guys. I mean, this is, humans have always understood this, right? It's not that you don't love them as fellow children of God, you just, right, you've got to regulate things in some practical way. This is what we're wrestling with. We're trying to get up high enough that we can deal, we can face facts, and we can keep matter and spirit separate. We can't treat matter as if it was spirit. We'll get very confused. And it all begins, the only way you can keep them separate is if you have a genuine religious consciousness. You've got to back away from the outer life. Back away, get in the lower domain, and then work your way up, back away from yourself, and then you can finally get up to eternity and spirit. Okay? You need to find that inner core. It's up to you as an individual. I can't do this for you. You have to journey in and up, and get that anchoring definitively bounded apart from matter and the external world. Get yourself grounded, founded in eternity. And then it will be natural for you to keep spirit and matter separate. It will never be confusing to you ever again. Once you've actually experienced spirit substance in contrast to fancy matter that you've been calling spirit, right? It's not confusing anymore. And so we need to do that. It's why the Urantia book talks about religion to the degree that it does. That's the starting point. And if we can get objective like that, then we can face these facts about biology, genetics. And
the thing the world needs most to know, the religious, that's the religious.
Right, the religious life of Jesus and how he lived it, right? And you need to literally have the faith of Jesus. Right? And again, that's why it's so important. Not the faith of Michael. You can't have the faith of Michael, a faith of a creator son. That's why his, in many ways, his public ministry is not really that helpful. It'll feed your primitive religious desires for signs and wonders, magic and stuff. Okay, but it's his private ministry. It's the Jesus, the man, right? You want to find that human religious consciousness.
Some of the teachings from the other part.
Right. Again, it's just trickier to keep, because we get so fascinated by the miracles and stuff, and it's hard to keep, for a lot of people to keep properly backed away from that, and that gets caught up in all that.
True.
But
the book kind of helps you get over that.
If you can keep a relationship to the wholeness of the book, it helps. But just, it's important to, just keep in mind what your natural tendencies are.
They do devote a majority of the Jesus papers to that other part.
Sure, right? Because it's important. It's important to clarify the fourth epical revelation. You're trying to build the fifth epical revelation on a foundation. If you don't have the foundation, how can you build it? Right? It's important to clarify. It's coordinated essential knowledge of the fourth epical revelation to build a new revelation of truth upon that foundation. I mean, it's indispensable.
The fact of his death was enough for the man, Jesus the man. He could have stopped the whole thing, and he didn't. He went ahead and went through the suffering and the crucifixion and that horrible death. I mean, that's the greatest example.
Right. I mean, obviously, you know, no greater love. I'm not dismissing the public life. I mean, there's some really important things there. Yeah, but just, you know, my point. Right, just appreciate that. Don't lose the man in the presence of the God. Right, which is a tricky thing. God shines pretty brightly. it's hard. You can easily lose sight of the man, and it's the religious life of Jesus the man and how he lived it, not Jesus the God, not Michael the God, right? Technically, yeah. So, all right. So we'll get the rest about the dispersion the next time. If you see, we're moving towards our final evolution paper here with the Over Control of Evolution. This is a really fun paper. So let's take a moment here, everyone.